U.S. Representative of Montana Steve Daines is joining other members of Congress for a week-long trip to Israel. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight, a Montana Evening Edition.
And in tonight's feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with the director of Sussex School about why social-emotional learning skills should be taught right alongside other core subjects. Montana's U.S. Congressman Steve Daines is continuing a week-long trip to Israel. He's joining 25 other members of Congress on the trip to learn about U.S.-Israeli relations, the peace process with Palestine, and political trends in the region. Daines also tells Capitol reporter Dan Boyce he's seeking to improve economic ties with Montana.
Congressman Daines is calling this trip to Israel a piece of his Montana jobs tour. He visited several Montana towns last week, including Bozeman, Butte, and Billings. He believes it makes sense to add Israel to that list. He says his nearly 30 years with Bozeman-based software company Right Now Technologies taught him how to build global businesses.
As Montana looks to the future, we're going to be highly dependent to grow our economy in Montana based on exports.
Israel is a very small piece of Montana's export market right now. About $1.5 million was exported last year. Daines hopes that could increase through promoting Montana's agricultural products and taking advantage of a growing Israeli tech sector. He also points to Sanju Industrial, an aerospace and defense company based in Kalispell.
We're going to be going up north, up to the border with Lebanon, and talking about what they call their Iron Dome project and the future of missile defense.
Sanju Industrial is supplying parts for Iron Dome, which is an Israeli rocket defense system. Daines wants to increase the dialogue about more of these kinds of opportunities. Peace talks between Israel and Palestine resume this week after nearly 5 years of silence. Israel released more than 24 Palestinian political prisoners ahead of the talks as a sign of good faith. But Israel also just approved the construction of nearly 900 settlements in a disputed area of Jerusalem, which could undermine those showings of goodwill. Daines says at least the two sides are sitting down together again.
These issues have been around for thousands of years and likely won't get solved in the next few months. But important is that both sides remain committed to a process of reconciliation, negotiation, and peace.
The trip is sponsored by the American Israel Education Foundation. That's a charity affiliated with the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, a powerful pro-Israel lobby group. Still, Daines says he is meeting with some Palestinian officials on this trip, including a scheduled meeting with Palestinian National Authority President Mahmoud Abbas on Thursday. Daines says the U.S. needs to maintain close ties with Israel, our biggest ally and the strongest democracy in the region.
So it's critically important, I think, that members of Congress understand firsthand what's going on over here to get a better picture to make us more effective lawmakers back in Washington.
He returns to the U.S. at the end of the week. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, state and tribal officials have signed an agreement to transfer 35 bison from the Fort Peck Reservation to Fort Belknap. The Great Falls Tribune reports the deal was signed yesterday by Fort Belknap Tribal President Tracy King and Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Director Jeff Hagener. A date for the transfer has not been set. The agreement comes nearly 2 months after the state Supreme Court reversed a lower judge's order barring relocations of Yellowstone National Park bison. FWP transferred more than 60 Yellowstone bison to Fort Peck in March 2012, with half slated to go to Fort Belknap. The bison spent years in quarantine to ensure they were free of disease. Ranchers and property rights advocates sued to prevent additional transfers, arguing wild bison damage property and spread disease.
The U.S. Bureau of Land Management is planning to hold a lease sale for an estimated 167 million tons of coal in Wyoming's Powder River Basin. The BLM says in its August 8th notice the 1,250-acre Hay Creek II coal tract sale is being held in response to an application filed by Kiewit Mining Properties Incorporated subsidiary Buckskin Mining Company. Kiewit owns most of the 1,250-acre tract surface estate, which is located 12 miles north of Gillette. The coal lease sale is set for September 18th, with sealed bids accepted until the day before. The minimum bid is $100 per acre. The BLM is taking comment on the proposed sale until September 17th.
No new fires in the Lolo National Forest today. However, fire crews continue to mop up old ones. Lolo National Forest spokesman Boyd Hartwig says the Gold Creek Fire, Woodman Saddle, and West Mullen Fire are all within perimeters, and firefighters continue to monitor those areas.
you're going to have pockets of unburned fuel. So it's not unusual to have to see some single tree torching within a fire perimeter of those unburned areas and see visible flames sometimes.
Hartwig says over the next few days, temperatures are expected to go up and so will the fire risk.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency has released revised preliminary floodplain maps for Missoula and Missoula County. These maps are the first countywide update since 1998. Missoula County Floodplain Administrator Todd Kleitz says that 25-year gap was most likely caused by a lack of congressional funding. FEMA has been working on the map revision since 2005. These floodplain maps are used to provide guidance for building purposes and also help set flood insurance rates. If someone resides in a FEMA-mapped floodplain and they carry a mortgage, they're required to carry flood insurance. Most of the major rivers and streams in Missoula County are covered by FEMA floodplain mapping. Kleitz says FEMA's made some significant revisions to these maps.
There's two-foot topography that was generated back in 1999. So with these 100-year flood elevations that have already been identified by FEMA, they were able to really dial in more accurately where that 100-year floodplain is. And that's basically from the Y down to Lolo Creek and over to East Missoula. In that area, the 100-year floodplain is a lot more accurately represented now on these latest maps.
Other changes were also made.
There's a part of the floodplain called the 100-year floodway, and in that floodway, by state law, you can't build any new structures. The floodway has always been identified on the Clark Fork River since the 60s down to Frenchtown, and if anybody downstream of Frenchtown wanted to develop in the floodplain, they had to hire their own engineers to determine where that floodway sat on their property. FEMA's done that now with completing the floodway status for the Clark Fork River down to the county line. LaValle and Butler Creek, west of Missoula, had what's called an approximate 100-year floodplain that was not surveyed or determined by hydrologic or hydraulic methods. They've done that now. They've got a lot more accurate floodplain map for LaValle and Butler Creek.
The 1988 version of FEMA's floodplain map for Missoula County covered about 780 structures within the 100-year floodplain. Kleitz says the revision actually reduces that number by about 50.
There's actually less people now that are shown in the FEMA map floodplain based on this more revised data than there was previously. But in Missoula County, we had about 250 people that we sent postcards to who had property that weren't in the 100-year floodplain before that are now potentially coming into it. So overall, while the numbers have reduced, some areas have increased.
Kleitz says these revisions will have important ramifications on those in the floodplain.
If you have a structure in the 100-year floodplain as mapped by FEMA, and you carry a mortgage, then you're required to have flood insurance. You're also required to comply with any kind of building restrictions that go along with having property in the 100-year floodplain. For instance, if you can identify an area where you can place a septic system, because if you're in the 100-year floodplain, a septic system has to be 100 feet away from the 100-year floodplain. But if you can find a place out in the county for a septic system and your property is in the 100-year floodplain, you have to build your new structure so that its lowest floor won't be impacted by flooding.
Missoula County's new FEMA floodplain maps are now available for public review and will be in draft form for at least 90 days. Kleitz recommends those interested in reviewing and commenting on them to Google Missoula County floodplain maps. They're also available at City Hall and at the DNRC office on Spurgeon.
Police say home invaders attacked two elderly nuns while they were sleeping in their Billings house today, leaving them with cuts, bruises, and broken bones. The women are with the Sisters of Charity of Leavenworth, but police did not otherwise identify them. Billings Police Department Sergeant Kevin Iflin told the Billings Gazette they were taken to a Billings hospital to be treated for non-life-threatening injuries. Details were few, and investigators were waiting to interview one of the nuns this morning. Two men broke into the home at 2:45 a.m. They assaulted and robbed the woman, but police did not say what was taken. Investigators did not have enough information to put out a description of the attackers. The Sisters of Charity of Leavenworth is a Roman Catholic religious order in Leavenworth, Kansas. The order is listed as the owner of the house, according to tax records.
A coroner's jury found a Billings police officer was justified in shooting a combative man who was high on methamphetamine and failed to comply with orders to get on the ground. The Billings Gazette reports the 7-member jury deliberated for less than 10 minutes today before finding the February 11th death of 32-year-old Jason James Shaw was a justifiable homicide. Officer Grant Morrison testified he had stopped behind a car outside a suspected drug house. The car's owner had several arrest warrants. When backup arrived, Morrison went up to the car and Shaw got out of the back seat. Morrison testified he saw the butt of a gun in Shaw's pocket and that he shot him when he reached for the weapon, which was a BB gun replica of a law enforcement handgun.
A Kalispell man who led Flathead County deputies on a chase before being held at gunpoint by an Evergreen couple has pleaded guilty to stealing the car he was driving. The Daily Interlake reports 27-year-old Jordan Lynn Elliott also pleaded guilty on August 8th to assault with a weapon and entered an Alford plea to fleeing from or eluding police. A plea agreement calls for dismissing charges of criminal endangerment, assault on a peace officer, and criminal mischief. Sentencing is set for October 8th. In March, Elliott stole a car and led deputies on a chase that ended when it crashed in Evergreen and he ran away. A man and woman who had been listening to the chase on a scanner apprehended Elliott in their yard and held him at gunpoint.
A man whose son shot a 10-year-old Great Falls boy to death in March 2011 has been sentenced to 20 years in prison for raping a woman in September of that year. The Great Falls Tribune reports District Judge Kenneth Neal sentenced Greg Allen Zindel yesterday to 30 years in prison with 10 suspended. During Zindel's trial, the woman testified that she, Zindel, and his brother had drinks and pizza at a bar and went back to Zindel's apartment. She said she was planning on going home, but after drinking a couple of sips of a drink, she felt tired. Zindel offered to let her sleep in his bed. She testified she awoke to Zindel trying to have sex with her. Zindel maintains his innocence and says he plans to appeal.
A Bozeman woman faces a felony theft charge after a man said he spent nearly $112,000 buying what turned out to be fake diamonds only worth about $26,000. The Bozeman Daily Chronicle reports Gallatin County prosecutors sought permission last week to file the charges against 47-year-old Georgia Cold directly in district court. Cold's initial appearance before District Judge Holly Brown is set for September 10th. Charging documents say Cold placed a Craigslist ad saying she was liquidating a gemstone business she inherited from her mother. Between May and August of last year, the man said he bought 70 items from Cold for nearly $90,000. He paid another $22,000 in September for 17 gemstones Cold said were diamonds, but were actually synthetic diamond substitutes called moissanites.
The director of a private Missoula K through 8th grade school attended a training seminar last month at UC Berkeley to learn more about teaching social-emotional learning skills. Sussex School's Robin Gaddy believes it's important for schools to teach skills that she says help develop the emotional literacy of students. Gaddy earned her Master of Science in Experimental Education. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, Gaddy explains why these social-emotional learning skills should be taught right alongside other core subjects.
And there's wonderful research that shows that children who are emotionally intelligent or adults that are emotionally intelligent do better in life. They do better in academics. They're able to focus more in a class when they understand what their own feelings are happening within themselves and what's happening within a group. And in our school model, we not only have an emphasis on critical thinking, but critical problem solving, and that involves groups. So our kids are constantly engaged where they are having to work in small groups.
Social emotional intelligence. It's kind of a mouthful. Specifically, what does that mean?
Yes. What that means is the movement right now in education in this country, and there's even a bill before Congress, is to teach our students social-emotional learning. So what that means is how to get along well with others, to be able to understand your own emotions, to understand what words to use to work as a problem solver in a group, to be able to navigate the complication of relationships. There's an emphasis on being aware of reading nonverbal cues, being aware of what are pro-social behaviors, what helps kids be successful and happy in life. That word happy sometimes can be overused. Mm. It's interesting, when I give a tour on campus, I'll ask parents, why have you chosen to look at our school? And they say, well, we want our kids to be in a thriving learning environment, but we also want them to be happy. We want them to like learning and like going to school. And I feel it is a responsibility of a school to be able to teach to the social emotional needs of a child. For me, when I think back to my own education, if I have something happening emotionally that might have happened on the playground, it's harder to learn that science lesson because I'm still back in that engagement that happened on the playground. And if we can teach our kids to navigate those relationships and to move through their emotions quickly with identification of, I feel this way because, and this is how I can solve that problem. I can talk with this person and then I feel better, and now I'm in a more peaceful place to be able to learn. And so at Sussex, we have an emphasis of individual coaching from teacher to student. We have a mentor program with bigs to littles where students can talk with one another. We have a peace table.
Bigs to littles.
Bigs to littles is a term that we use at Sussex for our mentor-mentee program. So younger kids are paired with older kids. And they work to develop that relationship over a year. They come together a couple times a week to do activities, to read with one another. And then it's also just a support person when they're out on our 2.5-acre campus to be able to say, oh, there's my big or there's my little. I'm going to check in and see how they are doing today. And what we have found through that program is that there is a kindness that is prevailing on our campus from the older to the younger kids, and a caring that's very authentic. It's very powerful for an older child to say, hey, you might not want to do that, versus me, for say, as the adult. There's something that's heard maybe in a quicker way on a peer level.
Ms. Caddy, these skills that you mentioned, reading nonverbal cues, problem solving, isn't this preloaded software? I mean, you either have it or you don't, yeah?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think that there some people are more prone to that intelligence, that interpersonal intelligence or the intrapersonal intelligence. But just like any intelligence within the multiple intelligence model, you need opportunities and exercises to build that intelligence. So how you build that intelligence is to solve problems within that domain. So, for example, if you and I were out on the playground and or we're working in a group in a classroom and you said something and I said something and we were at a conflict point, we have to get to the other side of that to be able to build that intelligence. Oh, I understand why I was triggered that way. I understand why what you're saying now. If I use these words, it helps build that relationship versus turn off that relationship. And by solving those problems within that domain of those intelligences, we constantly increase our emotional intelligence. And that is a wonderful life skill to be able to get on with relationships, to marriage, happiness in life, to work relationships.
Is there ever a time for a good old-fashioned shoving match?
No. Not at our school and not in my mind. I think that we have a responsibility to teach our students skills to be able to navigate those higher emotions. Sometimes it's just let's take a break and then we'll come back to talk with one another. But again, if you punch someone in life, there are consequences and there are negative consequences, and that's not how you solve conflict.
Where did this approach come from?
Well, it's been around a long time. It's wonderful that it's starting to gain more momentum in our country. This institute that I went to brought 62 educators from around the world together to say, what can we do in our schools? Teachers have been doing this for a long time individually. It's exciting to see whole school approaches to creating programs where we create a common language. These are our guidelines. These are our community agreements. At Sussex, we've had community agreements that involve similar things to all I ever needed to know I learned in kindergarten. Respect one another, keep safe boundaries, ask for what you need, those things. But in actual practice, the kids need more opportunities to go back and revisit those. And programs that are popping up in different parts of the country right now are more formula-driven programs where if you do this, then this happens. Or there might be a mood meter of, okay, there are four colors here. Which mood is speaking to you right now? So tangible programs to be able to build the skills from a kindergarten learner all the way to an eighth grade learner, because obviously those are different.
Are there vignettes as well? You have a small group of kids get together and you create a phony conflict and then you instruct how to go
right.
to solve that.
Right, yeah. We've done that in the past and we'll continue to do that because role-playing, and we have a wonderful drama program at our school, those types of role-playing really help kids try on different identities and build those skills without being in the middle of a conflict.
How effective is this, or is there a proven track record here, or is it just kind of too soon to know?
I think we've had a proven track record at Sussex in that kids feel safe at our school. They like coming to school. They feel that they'll be heard. Here is a great example. A couple of years ago, I had a middle school student transfer into Sussex. And just based on peer dynamics at that level, the student came in and started making fun of one of the other kids in the class. And it wasn't the teacher or me that had to step in. It was a couple of students that said, hey, we don't do that here. We don't make fun of other kids here. That's not okay. You can be whomever you want to be. And, you know, that is exactly the type of kindness, the type of language that we want to see at our school, where our students are actually carrying through with that.
What if it goes the other way? One of the students who's been trained in this goes to a public school somewhere else. Their parents move. Would they be eaten alive in a more traditional public school setting?
Well, we've had kids transfer, and we haven't found that. What we hear from our traditional schools in Missoula when we have Sussex kids that transfer is that Sussex kids are able to communicate in a way that speaks to questions they might have or their needs that they have. They easily navigate relationships. There's a confidence about them socially, and that's what we have heard.
What sort of impact does it have on the other side of the desk from the teacher's perspective?
From the teacher's perspective, it's very fun to teach a group of kids who are motivated to create an environment where anyone can be themselves, whether that you're wearing a certain hat to school or you like a certain sport. It's wonderful to teach motivated kids who are authentic.
Not trying to be snarky, but American schools generally have a challenging enough time teaching science, mathematics, English, literacy. Would you like to see this spread elsewhere, or can schools barely do what they're trying to, most other schools do what they're trying to do right now?
That's a great question. The research is compelling that if you take a moment to teach to the social emotional need of a child or a group, your academic memory and your academic engagement increases. So students retain information, they're more engaged because they've had the time to air out how they're feeling or have student choice. And there are teachers in schools all over this country, whether it be labeled a progressive school or a traditional school, that have done that since their career began. It's really neat to see a whole school approach, which we have at Sussex, and we have the ability to do that as an independent school.
Is this a school's responsibility to do this, or is this more a parent's responsibility?
Well, I believe that in education, students spend a big portion of their day, and that's where they're involved in relationships on a peer level. And I think it's the responsibility of a school to work this into a curriculum.
I've been speaking with Robin Getty, director of Missoula Sussex School. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you so much.
And in tonight's weather forecast for west of the Continental Divide, tonight expect mostly clear skies with some smoky areas. Lows will be in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tomorrow will be mostly sunny in the morning, then becoming clear with highs in the 90s. For central Montana, tonight calls for mostly clear skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms and lows in the upper 50s. Tomorrow expect mostly clear skies with highs in the upper 80s. And for southwest Montana, tonight will be mostly clear with lows around 45 to 55 degrees. Tomorrow calls for mostly clear skies with highs in the upper 80s. And now for the editorial comments of Dane Scott.
In July, NPR's All Things Considered reported on the Farm Bill. Legislators failed to pass the bill before vacation, which angered farmers who sell food locally. The bill contains the Local Farm Food and Job Act. This act marks an important policy shift to promote local foods. Supporters argue that locally grown foods are healthier and better for the environment. Less discussed is the importance of local food and farming for building community and strengthening democracy. In the aggressive quest to increase production and lower costs, U.S. agriculture has forgotten the social and political roles that agriculture plays in creating a good society. The local food movement can be seen as a development of a political philosophy with a long tradition, agrarianism. Thomas Jefferson famously championed agrarianism. Agrarians like Jefferson emphasized the value of local farm and ranch life for developing citizens who can make strong contributions to a healthy democracy. The new agrarians stressed the importance of living as much as we can within local economies, economies that keep the loop between production and consumption as small as possible. The local food movement cannot be easily dismissed as a fad, something for neo-hippies and well-heeled shoppers. Paul Thompson notes, the ideal of a local food community is a very new kind of agrarian ideal, one that orients hope toward the sustainability of the soil, the earth, that binds our practices together. Local foods and farming can contribute to creating sustainable agricultural systems and a strong democracy. There's always been a tension in American life between the individual and the community. Communitarianism is a school of philosophy that focuses on the importance of community to moral and civic life. Communitarians criticize individualism for elevating the freedom of personal choice to the highest good. This overemphasis on personal choice, they say, leads to selfishness, fragmentation, and isolation. The philosopher Michael Walzer identifies geographical and social mobility, which are sanctioned by individualism, as contributing to the loss of community. The new agrarianism is in part a response to these trends. More people are choosing to move from place to place during their lives. As a consequence, they are less likely to identify with a particular place as their home or community. This leads to a loss of sense of place, which in turn can lead to a loss of sense of community. Communities are often geographically and ecologically located. A particular landscape can be key in creating a person's identity. The geography of Montana helps create Montanans. The agrarian writer Wendell Berry comments, community is a locally understood interdependence of local people, local culture, local economy, and local nature. Farmers and ranchers cannot move around a lot. They must invest their labor in the land for the long term to be successful. This commitment to a specific place creates citizens who see their self-interest as being tied to the health of the local ecology, economy, and community. For those who have been denied social mobility, liberal individualistic philosophy has been a great ally. However, increased social mobility does have trade-offs. Rural agricultural communities are aging and in decline. Many children are choosing not to stay on the farm to continue the family business and contribute to the local culture. The passing on of vocations and customary ways from parents and the larger community to children can be an important for creating a rich moral and political identity. Further, when the family farm is passed between generations, there is continuity. In agrarian thought, this continuity gives rise to virtues that sustain the community and keep the land healthy. These virtues are lost when young people no longer see life on the farm or ranch as economically viable or personally enriching. While the philosophy of liberal individualism should be embraced for helping free people from oppressive social and political structures, it is a mixed blessing. There is a palpable underside of sadness and discontent that accompanies the loss of community. Food and agricultural policies may be a place where the government has an interest in favoring policies that help build new kinds of community through local foods. Food and farming provide a natural focus for bringing people together and strengthening the bonds of family and community. One need only think of the dinner table, family celebrations, harvest festivals, farmers markets, and the like to realize the role that food can and does play in building community. New agrarianism and the local food movement should be seen as a corrective to the excesses of individualism. It seems wise for the farm bill to finally turn its attention to supporting local farms, food, and jobs. U.S. agricultural policy needs to remember the important social and political roles food and farming can play in creating a good society. This is Dane Scott, the Mansfield Program in Ethics and Public Affairs.
Dane Scott is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.